Well, thank you. And welcome everyone to this event of meditation and teachings. We'll begin with the meditation. So please find a way of sitting where you're comfortable but upright so that the breath can flow easily and naturally. And feel free to take a few moments to really find your seat, to adjust yourself so that you're really quite comfortable and at ease. There's no point in trying to plunk yourself down and be in an awkward position and then try and hold it. And then as the body settles into the sitting posture, let the mind settle into the body and feel the body sitting. Feel the body breathing. Relax into this experience of simply being present now, sitting and breathing. Let your eyes gently close. And catch the breath just as it begins on the inhalation. Staying connected to the experience of that breath through the whole duration of the inhalation. And observe the whole exhalation so that we come very close to the breath, are intimate with the breath, and meet just this breath fully, the whole inhale and the whole exhale. How fully can you be present with this? Though we intend to observe the whole breath, sometimes we still find that the mind is lost in thought. Notice when you're thinking. We're not so interested in the content of thought. We're not interested in the story or the narrative so much. But it's vital that we recognize what activity is happening. We are thinking. So become mindful of thinking. Recognize the process of thinking, and then bring your attention back to the experience of sitting and breathing. Though much of the time in meditation, we simply notice thinking is happening and then returned to our primary practice of being mindful of the body, sitting and breathing, mindful of whatever's happening in the present moment, aware of sounds or temperature, whatever's present right now. There are times when we need to look at the thoughts a little bit more directly. And though we don't need to go into the details of the narrative or the story that we're weaving, we can notice, is this thought helpful or is it harmful? Is it a thought that's rooted in anger and greed and delusion? Or is it a thought that is of generosity and renunciation and kindness or wisdom? So as you're sitting and breathing, if you're mind gets lost in thought again, then after you notice that thinking is happening, look to see what type of thinking is happening. Put the thoughts in one of two categories, those that are helpful and those that are harmful. The Pali terms are kusala and akusala, wholesome or unwholesome. And sometimes it might seem as though, oh, this is a really important thought. I'm having a creative moment and I'm planning what I'm going to do in 2 weeks, or I'm finishing off some problem that I was working with at work. And we think, oh, this is helpful. But is it helpful now? Is it helpful for your meditation? Is it helpful for what you're engaged in right now? And the task I suggested was to observe sitting and breathing. So there are plenty of innocuous worldly thoughts that we wouldn't say were evil, but nevertheless, they're not particularly helpful right now. So just notice, is it useful or not useful? Is it helpful or not helpful? Is it wholesome or not wholesome? And then settle the attention again on sitting and breathing. So we explore our thoughts, but we explore them in conjunction with a simple object like the perception of breath in the body. You could actually choose any anchor, any meditation practice, endeavor to do anything, and then work with the thoughts that distract you from that. It's not necessary to use sitting or sensations or breathing. But I figure we're probably all breathing right now, so why not? when we give attention to the thoughts, we will soon enough recognize what our habitual patterns are. Do we tend to worry about the future? Do we experience regret about the past? Is there an anxiety about who we are, how we might perform, what we might say? Is there chronic planning? Is there a lot of judgment? Does the mind like to analyze and problem solve and fix things? Notice your tendencies of mind. You might even name them. If you notice judging, you can note it as judging, just to recognize that's what this pattern is. If you notice rumination, you can note it as rumination, or worry, or problem solving, whatever you notice. This can just help us get to know our tendencies and recognize them as that, a type of thought. Not the kind of person I am, but just the character of this moment of thinking. The characteristic of this is irritated or angry thoughts. Whatever you notice, just recognize it, add a name so it's very clear, label it, and then return again to the more neutral experience of mindfulness of the body, sitting and breathing. Well, in that meditation, I encouraged you to find an anchor, like the body and the breath. So you give the mind a certain task, and then to notice when you're distracted from it, when the mind is pulled into thoughts. Once the mind is pulled into thoughts, at some point you become aware that you're thinking. Now there's a chance there. There's an opportunity to now be mindful of thinking. So you recognize that thought is occurring. What is thought? Usually people, when they think of a thought, they think of the content. But it's very helpful when meditating to recognize, yeah, there is some content there, and it might be a certain type of thought, you know, a thought of the past in rumination, a thought of the future in worry, a thought of self-judgment, a thought of anger and blame, a thought of lust and desire. You know, there's different kinds of thoughts. There are also very beautiful thoughts, thoughts that are of clarity and wisdom, thoughts of kindness and compassion, thoughts of generosity. So there can be many different kinds of thoughts that arise in the course of meditation and certainly in the course of our lives, but they are thoughts. A thought is a discrete mental event. Can we look at thought and recognize this is a discrete mental event? This is a thought. It's not the objective reality. Just because we think something doesn't mean it's really true. Just because we have a view or an opinion about something does not mean that's the way things are or should be. It's just a thought. So in working with thoughts and working with distraction, it's important, it's vital to actually see that the problems are not distractions in the world. Distractions don't exist out there. It has to do with how we think, how we use our mind, how we relate to whatever is occurring. Now, the meditative exercise is to simply choose a very simple practice, and sitting and breathing is what I suggested, but you can do this with any kind of practice that you've undertaken. If you notice that you are distracted from your task, from the practice that you intended to do, work with those thoughts. Recognize that it's thinking, that thinking is a mental event that's occurring in the present moment. Already you've disentangled a lot of the content. And then to try to learn something, we look at the type of thought. Oh, that's a rumination. That's judgment. That's anger. That's generosity. That's kindness. That's a thought of letting go. You know, whatever the thought might be. So we learn a little bit about our tendencies. And then we can kind of classify those kinds of thoughts, those that are wholesome on one side and those that are unwholesome on the other. For the most part, the wholesome thoughts, we don't need to do anything with them, or at least not very much. We may let them go. We may sweep them aside when we're meditating so that we can concentrate our minds. But usually we don't need sophisticated strategies to overcome a distraction when we have a thought of kindness or generosity. The thoughts that we usually have to work a little bit more diligently with are the unwholesome ones. The thoughts that lead to anger or that perpetuate greed and lust or that keep the delusion going that I am this kind of person. I exist this way. The self is this. That is mine. All the deluded thoughts of conceit and arrogance and comparing. Those kinds of thoughts we then work more diligently with. So for many years now, probably almost 20 years, well, I guess 18, 19 years, I've been teaching a lot of concentration practice. So I have been emphasizing samadhi and concentration and training people, guiding people through the four jhanas. So that's been a big emphasis in my teaching. And over time, one of the things that became very clear to me is well after somebody has abandoned the coarse defilements of anger and and greed, or the movement of towards sensual desire, and that the hindrances have largely settled, restlessness is very often a lingering hindrance. And people need to work a little bit more diligently with this fetter of restlessness. From the insight perspective, for sure, but also from the tranquility perspective, so that the mind can become calm and insightful in relationship to how we use our minds. So there was a line in the Middle Link discourses, in a discourse called Two Kinds of Thought, that's sutta number 19, where it says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. It's a powerful statement, and many of you who've been listening to Dharma Talks have probably heard this quote before. Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of our minds. And then it goes on and it says, you know, if we frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, that clinging, that grasping, that movement of mind, then we are not cultivating the thought of letting go, of renunciation. And we are cultivating the thought of sensual desire. We are actually nourishing the hindrance. And if we're frequently thinking thoughts of anger or ill will or cruelty, then we are not, we've abandoned in that moment, we are not cultivating thoughts of kindness and compassion. We have actually given, we're giving our energy, we're cultivating the thoughts of those defilements of ill will and of cruelty. So we can look not just at the karma or the action that we do of body and of speech, but we have to look at the karma, the action that we do of mind, to see what is it that we are cultivating. Sometimes people think, oh, I'm in a rut, as though this has happened to me. And I really believe that we've created our own ruts. That's not to blame people. We all have our tendencies, but we have invested time and energy into certain thought patterns. And so we have deepened certain grooves. Some people are very inclined towards angry thoughts. Well, they've probably practiced them for quite some time, many, many years, thinking thoughts of blame or indulging in irritation. And so somebody is very lustful or thoughts of craving and greed. We might have some disposition in this way or in one way or another, but nevertheless, each time we engage in those thoughts, we are deepening that inclination of our minds. So I think it can be very empowering to a meditator to reflect on this statement that whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. And it invites us to realize that we can change the inclination. We can shift at least a bit out of one habitual groove and shift to something more useful, something more wholesome, something that supports our deepest aspirations and the potential for liberation. We can do that. We might need to be diligent. We might need to be vigilant. We might need to really work very, very vigilantly with our minds. But it's something I believe we can all do. So we're not, just because we have a certain tendency doesn't mean we are at the mercy of that tendency all the time. When it occurs, we can develop skills so that we can make those shifts in the tendencies of our minds. So I've been interested in this fetter of restlessness and thinking and the processes of distraction and focused attention. And I wrote a book called Beyond Distraction, which should be available now in bookstores or your favorite bookseller. It may still be on pre-order But we'll be, they're shipped, they're starting to ship out now. I know mine was shipped last week, so they should be available depending on where you're located or which bookseller you use. And Faith will put something in the chat feature to give you a link to where you can find out more about this book. So I got excited about this, the working just diligently with thoughts, because it's really the lingering hindrance for people who do concentration practice. All the other ones tend to fall away quickly. And then for a while, you still have to work with the tendency to think and the kind of the tendency of the mind to perhaps not yet want to settle into the deep stillness. So people have to train the mind, teach the mind how lovely deep concentration and stillness really is. So there were two discourses in the Middle Link discourses that I got excited about because they offer very pragmatic skills. The first is the sutta number 19, Two Kinds of Thought, which basically asks us to see, is it a wholesome thought? Is it an unwholesome thought? Is it a beneficial thought? Is it a harmful thought? And then we take those thoughts that are unwholesome and not beneficial, and we can work with those according to the strategies offered in the next discourse, also in the Middle Link discourses, called the Removal of Distracting Thoughts, sutta number 20. And in that discourse, the Buddha offers five specific strategies, things we can do, so very practical. They're exercises that we can practice, ways that we can engage in these habitual formations within our own mind that are active. Now, many times in meditation, it seems relatively like allowing and passive, in the sense that we see thoughts arise, we're mindful of them, and we let them go. And we don't really do very much with the thought. I think that still remains our main mode. I don't actually consider it passive. I think we have to be mindful, and mindfulness is very energetic and engaged. It meets the thought and knows that it's a thought. When we meet a thought with the mindfulness and the wisdom, most of the time, the vast majority of the time, that's enough. The thought falls away because we're now mindful of it and we're not feeding the defilement underneath it. And it falls away and we go back to our meditation practice, and that's that. But sometimes we find that there are a couple of patterns or thoughts or things for some reason that have, it's like we're hooked on them, like they capture our attention, and we've let them go already 10, 20, 50, 100 times, and those thoughts still keep arising, and we need to be a little bit more active with it. Unfortunately, most of the time, when people get recognized, this thought is driving me nuts, they just get almost violent with it, and they want to pound it away. And interestingly, that is one strategy, is to bring in determined resolve. But it's the last strategy. If we bring it in too soon, before we've developed the other skills, before we've developed the understanding and the wisdom, then we can actually be having aversion to those thoughts. We can be again acting on aversion instead of wisdom and a clear, powerful resolve. So I like this strategy because it included a certain strength of determination, but it placed that strength of determination in an appropriate place so that then we come to that strategy last. So what are the other four strategies that we practice first? And honestly, I think they resolve, again, almost all of the thoughts that weren't resolved just by being mindful of thinking. We bring in that strong energy very, 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 very rarely. But what do we first practice? First, we practice replacing. So if there's a particularly sticky thought, maybe there's a thought that uh, of of that that puts ourselves down, you know, that we're not good enough. We can't do this practice. We're so far from concentration. We'll never make it to be able to notice four breaths in a row. And we're having self-sabotaging, low self-esteem sorts of thoughts that can lead into doubt and that can corrupt our practice. Then first we recognize that it's a thought and maybe it just falls away. If it doesn't, then we recognize it's an unwholesome thought. And if it continues, we work with it because we do not want to entertain unwholesome thoughts, right? I mean, we don't. We know that they're painful. So why would we intentionally indulge them? So the first strategy is simply to replace it with a better thought, a more wholesome thought. The simile that the Buddha gives is of a block of wood that has a peg in it that's stuck in there. We can take a smaller peg and use the smaller peg to knock out the larger peg. But because that smaller peg is smaller, it doesn't get stuck in the block of wood. So we replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one, but we're not attached to the wholesome one. So we might, if we tend to have one of those thoughts of, I'm no good, I can't do this practice, blah, blah, you know, that really puts ourselves down, then we can think a thought of just valuing the effort that we make, trusting our intention, being willing to cultivate patience, something that tries to say, it's okay as it is. It's okay. It's okay. Let me just be present with this moment. Let me just be present with this. And individuals will find whichever kinds of things they want to replace. There's no set fast rule. You have to replace this kind of thought with that kind of thought, but it should be a wholesome alternative. You don't want to replace, say, kind of a dull state with anger just because it's a more energetic state, because now you have two hindrances, laugh and torpor and anger. That doesn't really help the situation. You want to choose a wholesome one. The classic suggestion is angry thoughts get replaced with loving kindness. You know, vengeful thoughts get replaced with compassion. If you always see somebody and you see things that you resent about them, make a point to notice things that you appreciate or value about them. Don't let your mind get caught in one groove. Give it an alternative. And just by doing that, you will have discovered that you can change. You're not stuck in that rut. You're really not. If you can think one thought outside that rut, you're not stuck in it. And you develop flexibility. You develop the skill to shift what you're perceiving and how you're relating to it. And for many times that's sufficient, but there will be some thoughts sometimes that keep coming back. So the next strategy is to examine the danger in those thoughts. The simile that's given is of the fisherman who puts a baited hook into the lake on the lookout for trying to catch a fish. And the fish that just sees the bait and doesn't see the danger, doesn't see the hook, will bite down, will cling to it, and will become somebody else's dinner. So similarly, we can, with that image in mind, we can recognize that sometimes we just see what we want and we don't see the danger. We just keep thinking certain thoughts because they give us a weird sense of familiarity. There's a gratification in that familiarity, and we're not seeing the hook. We're not seeing the danger. When we do see the danger, we see where those thoughts lead. We consider what will happen if I keep feeding this train of thought, and do I really want to go there? We realize that that's only going to lead to more suffering, and we develop dispassion. And that dispassion allows us to more clearly choose another route. But sometimes, after we've done that and practiced with both the replacing and the seeing the danger, Again, that works for many, many thoughts, but sometimes some pesky thoughts, they just keep coming back. You know, maybe we've practiced them for decades and decades, and it's going to need a little bit more. Then what's the next step? The next step is interesting. It says to withdraw the fuel. It says to withdraw your attention. It's a suggestion to ignore it, to avoid it, or forget it. And there are a lot of times that it's very skillful not to deny it, but to turn away. Because sometimes just giving attention to something itself feeds it. I've seen some meditators think, I just have to stay with this. I just have to stay with this. Mindfulness is about staying with this. But actually, our Dharma practice requires skill. And there are some things that it is not wise to stay with. There are many, many kinds of thoughts that if we stay with them, we actually feed them. We get angrier by staying with the anger, or we re-traumatize ourselves. Maybe we don't yet have the inner resources, the clarity, or the external support, or even just the energy that particular day or that particular moment to meet a thought and to that thought pattern and to be with it wisely. And in those cases, it is better to take a step back to be able to just turn away. And the image that's used in this particular discourse is of somebody who just shuts their eyes and doesn't see it. And we don't have to be afraid that, oh, we're not being mindful. We're applying wisdom. There are some things that it's wise to avoid. And we can give ourselves that opportunity to use a wide range of skills. But we don't avoid everything. And we don't get to avoid our patterns of mind for long. When we have developed, once we've turned away, we can develop stronger virtue, clearer understanding of the dynamics. We can develop more calm and stability. We can do many things in our practice, cultivate some loving kindness. We can do different things to actually build our capacity to meet difficult thoughts. And once we've done that, then we can progress to the next step. And the language of the next step is it's called stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. It's about going deep. It's about investigating the causes. What is causing those thoughts to form? So instead of looking at the superficial story, we might want to see the emotions underneath it. We might want to see understand what triggered it and how we related to those triggers. We might want to see understand how perception, thoughts, and views all interact in that dynamic. We want to understand so much about why we are vulnerable to getting caught in that dynamic again and again. And this is a wisdom investigation. It's very interesting. It's not there should be no anger towards ourselves for having this pattern. If we didn't have that pattern, we'd have something else. So we might as well be interested in it and explore it. And so we look deeply that interaction of mind states and thoughts. We look at how the conscious process functions. We look at how we know things. We learn so much about perception and cognition. And so we're learning about these patterns and we're learning about conditionality and we're really learning about Dhamma as we live it, as we experience it in this moment of mind. And what we often find is as we look deeper and deeper and deeper, we find that there are certain assumptions about self, certain biases that influence how we perceive something and that feed certain thoughts. There's certain beliefs and there are just a very kind of subtle sense of I am, because we may find that many thoughts are not just the coarse anger or sadness or fear or greed-based thoughts. Many thoughts are just subtle thoughts that say, look at me, I'm here. This is who I am. This is what I will say. This is what I have done. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And they're thoughts that basically construct self. And so it's as we look deeper and deeper and deeper, we'll learn a lot, and we may well have profound insight into not self and into the dynamics of identity construction, because they're very much at the root of so much thinking. At this point, we've resolved a lot of our reactivity, because now we're understanding, we're seeing with wisdom the causality. We're seeing how different conditions come together to create those patterns and what energies reinforce them. So there isn't much of a sense of this is my thought. It's about seeing the processes. So the mind is in a place of great wisdom and clarity. So now it becomes possible that if those thoughts have not yet been resolved, if they continue to arise, and honestly, they usually don't. Most of the thoughts will have been resolved with one of these earlier steps. But we can come to the fifth strategy, which is to really say no more to that thought. No more. Absolutely not. I will not give one more minute of my life to indulging in an angry, blameful thought. I will not give one more minute of my life to whatever that pattern is, that arrogant pattern, that conceited pattern, that greedy pattern, whatever it might be, whatever the defilement is. We say no. And it's possible to say no at this point because we've developed all the previous skills. Our minds will know that that means no. The image that's used in the sutta is of a strong man who might beat down a weaker man. And it sounds a little bit violent, but it really isn't. It's this strategy is only used when there's no aversion in the mind at all. It's a confidence that our virtues and our commitment to awakening is far stronger than our defilements, and that our commitment and our virtues, they dissolve, they overpower the defilements. So we're able from that place of a virtue and wisdom and understanding to say no and mean it. And this discourse then concludes with a beautiful statement that says, one is then called a master. Oh, just a second. Let me get off the paper clip so I can see the whole thing. One is then called a master of the courses of thought. One will think whatever thought one wishes to think, and one will not think any thought one does not wish to think. One has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit has made an end of suffering. It's a pretty powerful conclusion to the discourse. But this statement, to become a master of the courses of thought, to be able to think whatever thought one wishes to think and not think other thoughts one doesn't wish to think, that has excited me. That's such an exciting possibility to just not be a slave to those conditions. That excited me decades ago when I first read this sutta. And I thought, wow, you know, that's worth a little effort toward. That's worth striving to have such a commitment within the mind that my mind actually supports my deepest intentions and doesn't get distracted and derailed with habitual patterns or distracting thoughts. So it was my love of these two discourses and my recognition that restlessness is this subtle hindrance that continues for so many practitioners long after, the other hindrances have been resolved and fallen away, that inspired me to want to write the book Beyond Distraction, to provide very practical steps that we find right in the discourses of the Buddha. I didn't make these up, but they're relevant today, and we can access them and we can apply them so that we can bring an energetic and a skillful engagement to the patterns of our own mind, so that we're not a slave to the kinds of thinking that might arise in our minds. We don't need to deepen any of those ruts. There are alternatives, and with a little skill And with a little training, a little practice, we will develop the skills to become for ourselves a master of the courses of our thought and not think thoughts that we don't wish to think. Even just that, wouldn't that be, just imagine the burden of suffering that would have been alleviated in your life if you just didn't think thoughts you didn't want to think. It's pretty profound. So those were some of the things I wanted to share. The book that I wrote, Beyond Distraction, Five Practical Ways to Focus the Mind, published by Wisdom Publications, is, as I said, it's available, and I hope that you'll be interested in it. I also have an online course that's going to occur this fall. Registration isn't open yet, but it will be soon. On Beyond Distraction. So we could go through it together chapter by chapter and with additional exercises, with forum discussions, with weekly conference calls to resolve your questions and issues. So a look in about a month, I should have that up on the website. So you'll be able to join that class. It would be a wonderful way to read the book together. I also time those meetings so that they work for people in different time zones, usually morning in California, and a few, it works for Europe and other places. So, and then a few conference calls, maybe at a different time for people in Asia. So I hope you'll join us. And I am very happy now to entertain questions. I hope that you have some questions for me, either on these discourses or how to work with thoughts. So I'm opening this, ask a question, and I think I should see if there are some questions there. As you're composing your questions, I will just mention one or two other things about the book as I take a pause and wait for a question, please. I like exercises. So there are a lot of reflections, exercises, questions to ask yourself, really a lot of stories of how students have used this in their lives. This book is intended for meditators, but it's as relevant to everything in daily life. It's not just focused on working with this while meditating. It's probably a little bit more focused on working with the mind and the thoughts in the course of your daily activities, relationships, work issues, gossip, family dynamics, all those other things, because so often we can see how our minds work when we are confronted with various things in the world, people, duties, whatnot. So so I orient it from the Buddhist perspective of meditation. As we overcome restlessness, the mind becomes calm and still, and deep concentration becomes possible. But it's every bit as relevant to just being able to get through life and a day and actually like the condition of our own minds. So a question came that says, how do we distinguish helpful from unhelpful thoughts? If they are distracting us from what we are trying to focus on, aren't all thoughts unhelpful? I think it's a good question. And actually in Middle-Length Discourses number 19, the two kinds of thoughts, that said, make these two classes, those that are wholesome and those that are unwholesome. It says that first you can see what they're rooted in. Are they thoughts that are rooted in thoughts of letting go, renunciation, thoughts of kindness and loving kindness, and thoughts of compassion? Then those are good thoughts, helpful thoughts, wholesome thoughts. Or are they rooted in thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty? Then we know that those are harmful thoughts. Those are unwholesome thoughts. And we would work very vigorously with the unwholesome thoughts. And the simile that, the Buddha uses is of a cow herd who would guard the cows by constantly poking them to keep the cows from going into the fields when the fields were just before harvest, when there's so much temptation and the crops are thick and ripe. So one would be very diligent when we're around temptation, or when we're facing the possibility of going down that very dangerous route of indulging defilements, then we're going to need to be very vigilant. But when there's wholesome thoughts there, when there's thoughts of kindness and generosity, when there's thoughts of wisdom and compassion, then we still need to be mindful. But the images of the cowherd who is mindful by sitting in the shade of a tree, simply mindful that the cows are there. And so we can take a much more relaxed approach. We don't need to be right on top of every single wholesome thought. We might actually want to act on, we might want to allow space for the development of loving kindness. And we can do so with mindfulness, but we can give it space and we can nourish it. So we do have these different approaches, but that discourse continues beyond those two thoughts and says, even though these are wholesome thoughts and there's nothing to fear from thoughts of loving kindness and compassion and thoughts of renunciation and letting go, still, if I maintained them, then it would prevent my concentration. And so one abandons them in favor of the stillness of samadhi. So one then lets them go in order to concentrate the mind. So first we distinguish them, and then we choose our approach based upon what would be useful. Because there certainly are times when we want to indulge wholesome thoughts. You know, we're developing maybe a compassionate project. We need to think about it. We need to work on it. Maybe we're developing wisdom through a reflection. We need to pursue those thoughts. Loving kindness doesn't develop with just one thought of loving kindness. We maintain a continuity of thoughts of loving kindness to build up that perspective, that capacity that we have to deeply care. But then we also are not attached to it. So we can let even those thoughts go in favor of deep concentration. Thank you. That was a very wonderful question. Another question asks, can I speak about thoughts of fear? Now, fear is actually classified as in the same category as anger, as there's a whole bunch of things that we would consider to be emotions that would fall under the ill will, anger, hate, sadness, all of those kind of come together. Because, you know, there's greed, hate, and delusion. So kind of all thoughts get categorized into one or the other. But fear feels a little different. And I think it can be helpful to realize, well, there's fear perhaps because we don't want that situation. You know, that might happen. But we have to be very gentle with fear, not push ourselves into it, but to consider, first of all, is it fear of something that is a genuine danger right here and now that would be wise to back off from? And, you know, if we're snorkeling and we see a great white shark coming towards us, well, swim towards shore. You know, we wouldn't say, oh, I'm not going to have this thought of fear. I'm just going to keep my snorkeling going. No, we're going to just go to shore. That's not like a foolish fear. That's wise. But there are sometimes fears that are based merely upon our own previous thoughts, where there's actually nothing in the environment or our life that is causing the fear, that is a fearful, but we're caught in a cycle of fear. And so we give rise to thoughts that trigger our own fears, and then they feed each other, and it can build to anxiety and depression and can really be quite incapacitating. So it's worth working, but work with the thoughts of fear, but work very gently with them. You'll have to unpack and understand different qualities about it. Sometimes when thoughts of fear are strong, you wonder, well, what can we shift it to just work with the first step, like replacing? And you might choose sometimes a very positive thought that brings confidence. You know, oh, I can meet this situation. You know, some thought, it's difficult, but I can meet this situation. Or I can develop a skill to be able to overcome that difficulty. Or just a recognition that everything changes. Or you can move to something neutral, like the sensations of the hands touching, and just somehow feel a little more grounded in the present so we're not lost in the stories of fears. I think with thoughts of fear, we can work through the very same steps, but do so gently and gradually. Another question came. At stage 3, where I might notice that the thought is unhelpful, that might lead to self-blame and further distraction. For example, I'm always feeling angry, or I am also feeling mean. I can see how this leads to self-knowledge, but is there a danger it will decrease self-love and increase self-judgment? So from your question, I think you're talking about step 4. First we replace, then we examine the danger, then we try to step out of it, like withdraw the attention, ignore it, kind of take a break, and then we investigate. And it is important that when we investigate, that we do so without heaping more judgment upon ourselves. That what we're investigating are the dynamics, the processes of cognition, of causation. What causes that? So we're going below the personal story. The stilling the thought formations is looking deep at the causes, which are quite impersonal. They're just how minds and emotions and bodies and life works. It's not about me. It's just how this system works. So we start to understand how this functions, and it doesn't feel very personal. There is a system of investigation that you might be familiar with from other mindfulness classes. Vipassana teacher named Michelle McDonald taught this, I guess it was in the mid-80s, was the first time I heard her teach it. And it's become quite prevalent and, you know, in mindfulness circles over these last few decades. But it's the acronym RAIN, RAIN. First, we are recognize. Second, the A is for accept. We don't accept that we're always going to be like that. We accept that this is arising now. This is what is happening. We investigate and we do not identify. And so when we together recognize, accept, try to understand and investigate the process and do not identify, then we have a rather a nice acronym and system for exploring the mind without that kind of self, kind of self-judgment.
Hi, Shaila. If you scroll up to the top, there's some questions that have been voted. Thanks.
Okay. I would love suggestions for other anchors when meditating. I have anxiety and focusing on the breath is difficult for me. I am thinking of an object such as a mala, but would welcome other anchors I could focus on too. The breath is one object. Sensations are a marvelous object to choose a few touch points. Maybe you can feel where the body touches the floor, where the buttocks touches the whatever seat you're sitting on, where the hands touch, or the lips touch, or the eyelids touch closed. So you can feel different you can anchor your attention with different sensations, and you can move your attention through the through those touch points, kind of like a cycle. Or you can do some body scans, feeling different sensations. You can open to sound and hearing, and just notice the arising and passing of hearing of different sounds, and that can anchor you in the present moment. You can just open the field of attention to whatever is dominant, whatever sense door is impacted. And it, depending on your environment, it might be a lot of sounds, or it might be sensations, depending on how comfortable you are. So you can basically, with this method of overcoming distracting thoughts through this sequence of five strategies, we can do it in conjunction with any practice. If you were working with a mala, you can notice if you wandered off and then applied the strategies when you wandered off and then come back to the mala. If you were working with some kind of a mantra or some kind of a mindfulness of anything really, then it can be applied to those. You can work with mindfulness with breathing in various ways. Some people like to feel the belly breath, the body moving. Some people like the chest. Some people just like to know the breath at the tip of the nostrils. Some people like to have a very vast and experience of the whole embodied awareness of the whole body while breathing, so that we're aware of the whole breathing process. So if there's one way of knowing the breath that didn't work for you, you could try a variety of other ways to see. But in mindfulness of breathing, we don't control the breath. We don't control the length of the breath or the quality of the breath. We might direct our attention to the breath manifesting in different ways or different places in the body, but we don't try to develop some kind of special spiritual breath. We really let the body breathe and we just notice it. And it provides a continuity of a simple perception. But if it doesn't work for you, if the breath doesn't work for you, my second choice would be a body experience, sensations. And there's lots of ways of doing mindfulness of the body. And my third choice would be working with sound, because all of those develop mindfulness in the present moment. And you can also do the same work with thoughts of distraction while doing loving kindness practice or compassion practice. Because whenever the mind gets distracted, that's the time we apply these strategies. These five strategies are not the practice. They're the way of working with the distractions to the practice. Any other questions?
There's one more, Shaila, from Liz at the top.
When there's hurt by someone and maybe trust is broken, yet a need to still deal with that person who wouldn't discuss the problem, it can be difficult to bring loving kindness when there's a big elephant in the room. I ruminate on this way too much. Any further thoughts? This is a wonderful opportunity to bring loving kindness, because you might feel hurt and betrayed when you focus on that thing that somebody did and won't deal with it. And if one ruminates on that, one strengthens the view that that person won't deal with it or can't deal with it, and it really reinforces the pain. So we don't want to deny the pain, and we might need to, in many relationships, express how we feel and what we want and how we want to interact. Clear communication is vital to relationships. But all of that can still be supported by a mind imbued with loving kindness. So one can shift to just recognize something that you respect or value about the person. It could be anything. Maybe they're they're nice to their cat, or maybe they have some qualities of that you respect, some compassion, some honesty, some ability, something that is virtuous or respectable. So you don't, your view of them doesn't get locked down into that one experience of hurt. And so that's one thing, is to develop the skill within your own mind to be able to, yes, you can recognize that pain and communicate it when it's necessary, but the entire relationship doesn't boil down to that one thing. You can shift your attention to something else that you appreciate. So you're developing the skill within your own mind to shift to something you respect, or loving kindness. Or it could be equanimity. If loving kindness doesn't feel accessible, maybe just a kind of a more balanced view of the situation that will allow you to help see the other person's perspective. It may just be a way of shifting out of the thought, I am hurt, and maybe see, I wonder how the other person feels. What was going on there? What did they need? So that initial flexibility that we develop with the first strategy of replacing, it's hard to do these when we're in pain, and we shouldn't demand that we go further or faster than we're actually able to. But I think it's important to try to develop some flexibility so you don't get caught in that rumination. You can also sometimes just, when you let the thought go, not go to a thought of loving kindness about it, but just something else, like maybe the sounds, or maybe mindfulness of the body, so that you're just feeling yourself sitting or standing, or you're looking at the flowers in the springtime, so that your whole existence doesn't kind of collapse into that one painful event. And then you can work through the same strategies so that then you can see, what is the danger of ruminating on this? We can't control when somebody else is able to deal with it, but maybe we can deal with a lot of it ourselves. So what is the danger of that rumination? And sometimes we have to step away from it. We have to just let it go. Maybe there's something else that happens that you can work on together, and you just decide you're going to leave that issue outside. You'll deal with it later. You're not denying it. It's going to inform your sense of trust, because once the trust is broken, it doesn't immediately come back. But nevertheless, you're still going to work on this project together, or do this thing together, or eat this meal together, or whatever it is that you know, that brings you together, even before you're able to discuss the problem sometimes. And then you can do the investigation, and it may be an investigation to understand how maybe anybody would be hurt like that in the same situation, but how is it that you were hurt? So you understand what it triggered for you, and that understanding can be very healing. So you can move through the same steps. And then with the resolve, probably there might be a time when, if it's clear that the person is never going to discuss this with you, and just won't, you might need to let it go and just have that resolve to move forward. It might be that you decide you don't want to be engaged in that relationship anymore because you can't communicate. There's lots of possibilities of the outcome. This sequence doesn't always have some soft, loving kindness kind of everything is happy in the end kind of experience, but it gives you options to explore so that you're not just caught in the same rumination over and over again, that really will be re-hurting yourself with every thought. So it gives you a chance to work with it in a variety of ways. And you don't just resolve it necessarily with one sequence through the system. Sometimes we have to go through the different strategies a number of times, or we need to stay with one of them for quite a while. But I would suggest working through that in order. You know, maybe for a week or two, just work with the first strategy of replacing it. Try replacing it in different ways. Develop the flexibility to know that your mind is not stuck in that. Because when you're just thinking it, you're not really working with the relationship. You're working with the rumination. you're working with the rumination. Oh, what was the example for the fourth method? Oh, the simile. Oh, yes. I didn't tell you that one. The simile for the fourth step of investigation, stilling the thought formations of the thoughts, is of somebody who, you know, is walking really fast and decides, why am I walking so fast? Let me walk slower. And then while he's walking slower, he thinks, why am I walking slowly? Why don't I sit down? And from sitting, thinks, why am I sitting? Why don't I recline? And one goes from the coarser, more agitated states to something calmer and subtler and deeper in a way. So the idea is we're looking from the superficial story that we're reacting to, where there's a lot of agitation, and we're looking deeper and deeper. We're looking for the subtler causes. So we're going from the coarse to the subtle. Well, we just have a couple of minutes before we come to the closing, so I think I'll wind up here. I think I got all the questions. Faith, if you see a question I didn't respond to, please let me know.
No, I think we're all good.
Okay, great. Well, then I want to thank you for your attention and just remind you again that your support of Sangha Live and my teachings and the teachings of all the Dharma teachers that share this traditional wisdom is much appreciated. So your gifts of donations and dana is greatly appreciated. So I want to thank you in advance for that and remind you that the button is on the bottom of your screen where you can make a donation. And I hope that you will get my book, Beyond Distraction. It was really fun writing, and it will be really fun to work with you and hear your comments about it as the year goes on. And remember, if you'd like to walk through the book together in the fall, that course will be offered through bodhicourses.org, bodhicourses.org. And you can find links to that if you forget Bodhi Courses' name. You can always just search my name, shilacatherine.com. We'll find links to all that I teach. So have a wonderful day, and thank you very much.